You don't have to wait for legislation to put the 2009 bonuses of your senior executives up for a shareholder vote. You don't have to wait for a law to overhaul your pay system so that folks are rewarded for long-term performance instead of short-term gains. The fact is, many of the firms that are now returning to prosperity owe a debt to the American people.
Hello and welcome to NPR's Planet Money. I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Alex Blumberg. Today is Monday, September 14th. That, at the top of the podcast, was President Obama. He's in New York today and giving a big speech. Actually, he was on Wall Street talking about the financial crisis.
And he gave us today's Planet Money Indicator.
The indicator is 17%, 17% return on investment.
In his big speech, President Obama said today that a few banks have paid back those loans that the government gave out last year, you know, the $700 billion bailout and all that. And so far, on at least a pocket of those loans, the government has made a 17% return on investment.
Right. Of the ones that have paid it back, they've paid it back with a good return.
Right. But there are still hundreds of billions of dollars in unpaid loans out there, and far too early to say, hey, you want to make some money? Go bail out some banks.
Okay. All right.
So we are excited. This is a very special podcast. We are going to play greatest hits excerpts from an event you and I hosted, Alex, recently in Washington, D.C. It was at the headquarters of the Pew Charitable Trust. We were doing this event with the Pew Charitable Trust.
In front of a live audience. And the event was basically about this idea that both we and they have been thinking about and talking about, which is, how do you do this one simple thing, fix our nation's broken financial system?
But if you have one hand tied behind your back,
exactly.
Because you have to get bipartisan.
Because
it's so easy otherwise. Exactly. So
right.
What Pew did is they said, what basic principles can we get a whole bunch of people from the left wing, the right wing, the center, to all agree on?
Right. They basically did your dream of just getting this broad bipartisan consensus of experts together in a room and to see if they could hash out some solutions.
And we were there.
Right. So we set up this event with them, and we couldn't get everybody on the panel to participate, and we wanted to make it sort of fun. So we sort of structured it a little bit like a congressional hearing, a little bit like an American Idol thing, a little bit. We had this panel of judges. There were four people. We chose four people from this Pew panel. Martin Bailey, an economist at the Brookings Institution. Alice Rivlin, a former Clinton administration official and former vice chair of the Federal Reserve Board.
They're both Democrats on the other end of the political spectrum. We had Charles Calamiris, a professor at Columbia who advised the McCain campaign, and Peter Wallison at the American Enterprise Institute, who is a strong free marketeer. So those four were the judges. And then we had six different people come up and present their ideas for how to reform the system.
We'll get to those people in a second.
And Alex, I think, you know, these are all economists and they have a these are all economists. We talk to a lot of economists. And you know, the whole point of Planet Money is to make sure that we take really complicated economic ideas and present them in a way that the average person, the non-expert, can understand them. In fact, whenever I'm doing a story or a podcast, I have one guy in mind. It's my dad. He's a smart guy. He's a big NPR listener. But he's not a huge expert on derivatives oversight or capital reserve requirements or any of those things. So whenever I do a story, I want to make sure my dad understands it.
And so with that in mind, we started this whole event at the Pew Charitable Trust with one very special introduction. I would like to introduce Adam's dad, Jack Davidson.
All right. So dad, I'm giving my dad this bell. Dad, ring the bell. Right. When any of the panelists or the presenters say something that's completely confusing, just ring the bell, and that's a message that you guys have to translate what you're saying to plain English.
All right. Now we'll fast forward on to the rest of the evening. Where we started was on an issue I think everyone agrees on, left, right, and center, which is this. We never, ever again want to be in a situation where we, the taxpayers, are told you have to bail out these huge financial firms make them not have to pay for their mistakes or else face a massive Great Depression.
Right. And so how do we make sure that never happens again, that we're never in that awful situation again? That's what our first two presenters talked about. First up was Dr. Bob Lytan. He's an economist at the Brookings Institution and at the Kauffman Foundation.
Here's my suggestion, that if the government is likely to bail out such a large, systemically important financial institution, the government should try and discourage bigness by imposing costs on it. Let's identify these so-called too-big-to-fail institutions and, in effect, tax them for being so large.
Simple, says Robert Lytan. Big banks are dangerous. Charge them a lot more money than you charge medium-sized banks, and that will discourage banks from being so big we have to rescue them.
Right. Now, the other presenter is Scott Talbot, our favorite bank lobbyist. He works for the Financial Services Roundtable. It's a trade group representing the 100 largest financial service companies in the United States. So in other words, a lot of the companies that Bob Lytan would like to impose this bigness tax on. And no surprise, Scott doesn't like the idea of taxing his member companies.
There are institutions that are big, but we shouldn't focus on punishing them simply because they're big. We shouldn't focus on taxing them or imposing restrictions simply because they are big. What we should focus on instead is the risk that these companies are taking, the positions that they're taking, the riskiness that they pose to themselves, to the system, as well as their customers.
Okay, so these two guys finished their presentations. We had a little bit of a debate going, and then Alice Rivlin, the former Fed vice chairman and one of our judges, came out with this question.
I just want to say something a little more drastic and get a reaction to it. Bob has said attacks on bigness make it expensive for institutions to be big, and then if they fail, resolve them in an orderly way. How about starting the other way and saying, we have proved to ourselves that we have a lot of institutions that are too big to fail, maybe even too big to be efficient. And why not break some of them up now before they fail?
So in other words, just make break up big institutions, make them smaller. Just have almost like a size limit.
Right.
And Scott, that I think you probably endorse that proposal.
Sure. Yeah, I think your clients would go for that, right?
Where do I sign up?
He'll have a lot more members if you do that. You'll double his membership.
But she brings up the point that many people say a company as big as Citibank literally cannot be managed. There's no human being who could do it.
Yeah, I would disagree with a number of the assertions. Obviously, we need big companies, and they can be managed, and they are being managed.
But why? Why do we need big companies? Why do I need a Citibank?
Yeah, they provide a number of benefits across the globe. We have a global economy, and these institutions can handle the finances of the world. They can also handle the finances of large non-bank institutions like General Electric or Johnson & Johnson. They need these institutions that can handle the complex transactions. Simply breaking them up, and I'm not sure what criteria you would use, but that would be a good source of a good debate. That doesn't seem to be the answer, because then you're discouraging a company from achieving the American dream, working hard, earning money, producing products, and getting bigger. As long as you put in the right regulation, the regulations weren't ineffective, they were just the wrong regulations. They weren't modernized for the system, and that's what we need to change.
But
that's
the
better solution.
The American dream is not getting bailed out by the government.
Correct. So let's set up a system that doesn't punish you from getting large, but insures against risks that would hurt the system. And if a company's too big and they make bad mistakes, they should fail.
So one of the most contentious moments of the entire evening was about this too-big-to-fail issue. Peter Wallison, he's a firm free marketer, a former Reagan guy, he says that Bob Lytan's proposal to tax bigness, it would backfire. Because when the government has some public list of financial firms that are too big to fail, well, then everyone would know that they have a government guarantee.
So they would take on huge risks. Now, Wallison got into this fight with Michael Barr, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. And for the argument to make sense, just a few quick pointers. You need to know that Peter Wallison's big issue, his obsession, is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Those are, of course, or at least they were until the government rescued them, two private companies. But there was this implicit guarantee that the government would rescue them if they ever gotten into trouble. And now
which
we know
it did.
Now we know it's true. Right. And Peter, for decades, has been arguing that is too dangerous. Anytime there is a company that everyone knows will be rescued by the government, no matter what happens.
And that the company itself knows will be rescued
by the government. And the company itself knows, they will will take on bigger and bigger risks, and people will not demand from them the same kind of prudence they demand from companies that could fail.
Michael Barr from Treasury says those big banks and other financial firms, insurance companies, hedge funds, mortgage brokers, they'll have to keep on hand extra money in case of a crisis. So they won't be like Fannie and Freddie. They'll have to keep this extra money on hand. And keeping this extra money for a crisis, that's called maintaining higher capital ratios. Wallison doesn't believe this will solve the problem.
Higher capital ratios do make a lot of sense for banks. For banks, they shouldn't cover non-banks. Non-banks are risk takers.
So I just think
they shouldn't be regulated.
Peter, you can see the last experience we have. If you create another set of loopholes where institutions that are unregulated outside the system become too large, they're going to pose risks to the system, and all of us are going to pay.
And
I don't think we should let them manipulate their corporate form to decide whether they have enough capital requirements.
All of us will pay when we have to resolve every institution, non-bank institution, that might fail.
We shouldn't have to resolve them.
Well, let me ask you this.
We should have higher capital standards on them. We should have tougher restrictions on them. We should have many of those institutions, if you build the buffers right, can fail. We require them to have plans for their resolution. And in extremis, there may be cases in which they need to go through special resolution, but there is no way in which they should be entitled to any kind of special treatment.
Right. Okay, let me ask you this then, just a simple question, and that is, how can you tell the difference between a company that, when it fails, will simply cause disruption in the economy, and one that, when it fails, will cause what we're supposed to be protecting against, and that is systemic risk?
I think, Peter, precisely because that question is so hard, you want to build your system so it's more resilient to failure. Our largest, most complicated firms need to have more capital requirements. They need to have better risk assessments. They need to have more activities restrictions. That's got to be, bigger buffers have to be built in the system precisely because you don't want to be left in a situation
so
in which
you don't,
the
you
government
don't know
in the
which
end
companies,
is trying to make those.
You don't, first of all, you don't know
I'm not
which
smart enough
you're
to know which
about.
Ones those are.
Right, exactly. But
which
someone
ones are,
has
no,
to.
No, which ones we're going to fail.
You,
I know which ones in advance.
You
I want
to
have bigger buffers.
You're going to have to
bigger
designate
capital
these companies
in
advance in order to put these capital requirements on them.
You've got to have higher capital requirements on the biggest firms. There's just no way to accept that. Unless you do that, you're deregulating the system. You're making it even worse than the one we have
then
now.
Then we have Fannie and Freddie.
And taxpayers are going to be paying every single day.
Then we have Fannie and Freddie, and that's what you're proposing to do, and that is to create
no,
Fannie Mae and
that.
Freddie Mac in every sector of our economy where you designate these
companies. I fundamentally
companies.
Disagree. We're talking about what firms need to have higher capital requirements on them. They need to have higher capital requirements and more stringent restrictions on them, or they're going to bring down the system again.
At this point, another one of our judges, Martin Bailey, jumped into the fray.
The regulators didn't do their job. Under your system, why are they going to do their job? Are they going to have more expertise? Are they going to be paid better? What is it in your system that makes sure that next time the regulators do their job? There were rooms full of regulators in these banks that went under.
I think there are two sets of things you have to do. One is you have to have a system without loopholes so that we're sure that everybody is in the system, can't manipulate it based on their form. And second, you need to build in bigger buffers because we're not going to always get it right. I think you need to have a system that is humble, that is able to understand that regulators are going to make mistakes, that financial institutions are going to go too far, they're going to make mistakes, and there are going to be failures. You need to have a system that's more resilient to that.
I just want to say I'm thrilled to announce that NPR is announcing a new radio show after Car Talk. It's Michael and Peter discuss regulatory reform.
Car Talk is one of my favorite shows.
That's a good joke, Adam.
Thanks, man.
Sure. So after Too Big to Fail, we moved on to our second topic, consumer protection.
This is where we get to what I think the average person really associates with the heart of this crisis, the mortgage. You know, back in the housing bubble, there were all sorts of those crazy mortgages. We've talked about them, low-doc, no-doc mortgages, mortgages where you didn't have to prove you had a job or that you made any money.
Yeah, like my favorite, the Ninja Loan, which stands for, it's an actual acronym, and it was actually a loan that was given out. No income, no job, no assets. That was the loan. And there was also payday loans that charge huge interest rates and credit card fees that end up being an effective interest rate that's very large.
Now, there are many, many regulators in the U.S. who are supposed to keep an eye on this kind of thing to make sure the consumer is not getting cheated by their banker. But our next presenter, Adam Levitin, who teaches law at Georgetown, says that what we need is actually a new regulator, a consumer finance protection agency.
The solution then is to fill the regulatory void by consolidating consumer protection into a single agency with a dedicated consumer protection mission and the tools to carry it out. Research, rulemaking, and enforcement.
Now, Adam Levitin's proposal is pretty close to what the Obama administration is proposing, a new agency that will make sure consumers don't get screwed by confusing unfair products. Diane Casey Landry with the American Bankers Association, she's our next presenter, and she, no surprise, didn't agree. Everyone wants consumer protection, she says, but it'll cost too much money and cause too much confusion to have some new regulator. She says it's especially not fair to her members, most of whom are small banks, who didn't do anything wrong in this crazy crisis that we had.
If you have a new government agency, you'll pay more. And the reality is that the vast majority of consumers don't need it. So we need to fix and cure the gaps in our existing system. And we want to make sure that we don't overburden it and create a new bureaucracy that we're going to have to pay $4 billion, $5 billion to fund on an annual basis.
One of the judges, Charles Calamiris, who teaches at Columbia, says this argument about whether there should be a new agency or there shouldn't be a new agency, that that misses the point. The argument shouldn't be about the structure of the regulators, but about the content of the regulation. What specifically should regulators be doing?
One thing we had been doing, but not enough of, is putting testers out into the market to make sure that mortgage brokers actually are behaving honestly with people and then to punish them. But we weren't budgeting much resources toward that. That's content. We should be doing that. Another thing is, if you've ever filled out a mortgage application, it's a mountain of paper. There's very little content in it. You can't figure out what is in it, and you just want to get through the big stack. What we need to do is create real meaningful disclosures, streamlined disclosures, and put some teeth into those by minimizing the amount of paper, but making the content more meaningful. I think the problem, there may be a structural problem. I'm not against the idea of having a Twin Peaks approach. Maybe it's a good idea. I don't know.
What does that mean?
Twin Peaks approach means having a consumer protection regulator and then a prudential regulator being separate. It might be a good idea. It might not be. But all this talk about structure and is it the Fed or is it the, seems to miss the point that it's content.
Well, let me ask you that, Adam. Why can't we just rewrite the rules and like enforce the existing rules? Why do we need a new bureaucracy?
The problem is that we actually have some pretty good rules on the books. There are certainly gaps and there are areas that have not been covered enough, but we have agencies that haven't been aggressively enforcing the existing rules that, you know, that we, if you were to look at the Office of Comptroller of the Currency, which regulates national banks, there have been almost no consumer enforcement penalties, consumer protection actions that have resulted in penalties over the last decade. This isn't just a problem of the Bush administration. It went back into the Clinton administration. I'm not sure how one would empirically show regulatory capture. I can tell you about it anecdotally, but I don't think there's any way to show it empirically. But if you want the best anecdotal evidence, look at Countrywide Mortgage. Countrywide had been a national bank, and they didn't like the regulation they were getting from the OCC. So they went to the Office of Thrift Supervision, which another bank regulator. And they said, what can you offer us if we switch our charter and bring our business to you? Well, Office of Thrift Supervision said, we'll let you choose your own appraisers. And when that opened the door to all kinds of mischief at Countrywide. That allowed them to issue loans where the property value was inflated, and frankly, there was really no equity cushion there for the homeowner in the end.
Equity cushion,
equity
I bet
cushion.
You.
People, bank, they can shop for who regulates them?
Yes, that's what's amazing about this.
No, they cannot.
They can, no. They do, and this is,
they
this
absolutely
is a
do not.
If you were to take a banking regulation class at any law school in the United States, the main topic would be who regulates institution and how does the institution find the best regulator for it?
But the reality is that you're talking about it from a classroom. You might as well go out there and be an examiner and realize that people do not shop their charters.
Don't shop their charters. Just look at Colonial, which failed recently. They were moving their charter all over the place as soon as the regulators got wise to them.
We have banks in this country, 96% of which are well-capitalized and are well-run institutions. We have a fraction of which today are problematic. And the reality is you don't regulate and set new regulations of an entire government bureaucracy because of several institutions that have failed. And even if we get a couple hundred, the reality is we still have a well-banked system.
And the system hasn't worked, and it's hurt a lot of people.
God, I'd my consensus dream worked. Is dying, but it's such good radio.
I know.
But I want to go back and actually address something Charles said. You drilled into me about, why are you saying this is all structure? This is really about substance. And substance is what matters, but you can't get the substance to work unless you get the structure right. And the other reason I've focused on structure is that's what the legislation on the table does. The Consumer Financial Protection Agency Act is a structural act. It's not saying, here's how to regulate mortgages, here's how to regulate credit cards, here's how to regulate debit cards. there are good and specific debates to be had about all this, and I don't think Diane and I would reach an agreement on any of those. But I think on the structure, actually, we can reach agreement on one point. I think we can agree that there needs to be a uniform regulatory umbrella for all types of institutions offering financial products. Banks should not be playing with a different set of rules than non-banks. That the mortgage brokers should be regulated just like banks.
Is that, can you
agree? I agree with that.
Oh, whoa.
But that's about all I agree with. But I agree with that.
So we do get a little moment of agreement there. Now, one of the things, much of this work, this protecting the consumers, was supposed to happen at the Fed. And Adam, you brought this up in a question that you asked.
Okay. We happen to have someone who used to be the number two person at the Fed, Alice Rivlin. Is it fair to say you guys just, you didn't care about us, the regular guys?
The Fed did have a consumer protection effort, and there were people who tried, but it was not their core mission. I agree with the speaker. I also agree with Adam, who started off by saying we've got a lot of consumer protection agencies who have it as their second or third or fourth job. And it does seem to me that creating a new agency with that specific mission would be a good idea. I don't think, Diane, that it has to be a bigger bureaucracy than we've already got. It would be pulling together out of the other agencies the consumer protection mission. Now, there's always the fear they may do it badly, but we've already been doing it badly, so why not try this?
Can I push back on that idea of a bigger bureaucracy? Isn't that sort of, I mean, if what we're saying is that a lot of stuff got missed, people weren't out there, people weren't doing the things that they should have been doing, isn't that exactly what we need then, a bigger bureaucracy? Isn't that, I mean, is one way of looking at it is that, well, we do need a bigger bureaucracy then, because that way they can take care of all the things that they missed.
Well, I would say you need to close the gaps in the regulation, and that there are not examiners to go into the other lenders. There are not examiners to take a look at that mortgage broker that was looking at the products or the other people in the system, and they do need to be looked at. And
but that's
bank,
what I'm saying is if you're going to either beef up the existing regulation, in other words, increase the size of the existing bureaucracies or create another bureaucracy, you're still expanding bureaucracy. Even if you're doing what you're saying or if we're doing what Adam's saying, right?
I wouldn't call it bureaucracy. Yeah. I think that's the wrong term. I'd say you're increasing resources, and that you that does not. I don't want to be glib about this. That you can there are certainly efficiencies that come from instead of having a number of agencies replicating each other's efforts. If you consolidate them, there can be efficiencies from consolidation.
But I guess I don't see where they're replicating. And while the Fed's primary mission may not have been consumer protection, there is a dedicated division in the Fed, the OCC, and the OTS. In the FDIC of consumer protection examiners was a specialized career path that they can go out there and do the examinations. You do not have that today for the broker, for the pawnbroker, for the cash checker. There is no examiner that goes in to see what they are doing. Banks have on-site examinations. And I would tell you that there are enforcement actions that are drawn against banks for failure to comply in the consumer protection laws.
They're
maybe
almost
not
all
enough
flood
for your
it's almost all about requiring flood insurance when you're not in a floodplain. If you go through the OCC, that's what they go after. Not about that you're making mortgages to people who have no chance of actually paying it back.
But I think Diane is making my case that you really do need an agency whose job is filling in those gaps, among other things.
But I don't think you need an agency for the banks. I mean, you may need an agency for everybody else, but we're saying is we do not need an agency for the banks.
Craig got a little rowdy during this section, didn't they?
Yeah, it's nice when you can get a crowd rowdy about financial regulatory reform.
Yeah, exactly.
So the third panel was about derivatives, everyone's favorite topic. There are lots of different kinds of derivatives, of course, but most people these days, when you talk about derivatives, you're talking about those unregulated financial products like credit default swaps that nearly brought down the insurance company AIG, and with it, the whole global economy, we're told.
We had two presenters on this topic, Daryl Duffy, a Stanford University finance professor, and Mark Brickle. Now, Mark has been in the derivatives industry for almost 3 decades, and he's currently the CEO of a company setting up a platform to trade derivatives.
They both agreed that derivatives have gotten a lot of bad press lately, and that bad press isn't entirely fair. They both felt that derivatives, when used properly, allow companies to run more efficiently with less risk.
When used badly, many say they can destroy the world, but...
Yeah, so Duffy says there is a way to let companies use derivatives safely without risking the world destruction, it's simple. Just make sure everyone trades the most popular derivatives through a middleman, what they call a clearinghouse.
Right. Now, a clearinghouse, this way, if I have a derivative contract with a bank and the bank goes under, I still get my money because the clearinghouse will pay me. The bank won't have to pay me. The clearinghouse will pay me. And this is sort of basically it's what Daryl Duffy says is the clearinghouse stands between all the buyers and all the sellers.
According to Daryl Duffy, clearinghouse reduces systemic risk. Mark Brickell does not agree.
I'm saying a government-mandated clearinghouse is a dangerous idea. We just spent 25 minutes talking about the problems that are caused when you create too big to fail institutions. Should we tax them, regulate them, break them up? Well, wait a minute, Washington. Let's take a step back. Let's don't create so many of them.
And so you're saying a government-created clearinghouse would be just another too-big-to-fail institution?
I think it would, and I think the government would tell us that it would be too big to fail. It would be connected to many participants, and it would have to be propped up.
Well, Alex, I would disagree.
This is Daryl Duffy.
I mean, we have government interference in other markets, for example. When we have pollution, the government needs to step in because companies that pollute don't really have the incentive to reduce their own pollution. We have to have some method to do that. It's the same thing with these derivatives. To some degree, they're posing what's called systemic risk, which is like financial pollution. We need a way to reduce that when companies don't find it in their own incentives to reduce it. I'm not saying they should be mandated. They just need to be encouraged.
Now you're both saying, though, if I'm correct, that these things were not the heart of the problem, that perhaps they help spread the problem, but they're not the heart of the problem, right?
That's
true. I think
true.
We agree about that.
Yeah.
So, Alex, that evening was hugely ambitious. We took on an awful lot.
In retrospect, it might have been a little too ambitious. It made me realize that, like, why these congressional hearings, they take so long. You really need a lot of time to get through all this stuff, even without the grandstanding that you get from, like, the various politicians.
And you have to listen to the argument, but then you're also paying so much attention to who's making the argument. What is their agenda? What is their angle?
I know. And this is like one of the things that I find most confusing, especially about financial and regulatory reform. Like, let's take Mark Brickell. He makes very reasoned, logical arguments, but he and his clients also don't want the government coming in and doing anything that will hurt their profits. But on the other hand, he's been in the business for 30 years, and no one knows more about derivatives than him, arguably. So he's, at the same time, the best person and one of the most compromised people to listen to about this stuff, you know?
As are many of our other panelists, people who have a dog in the fight, but also know an awful lot.
Yeah, yeah.
So the Pew Task Force is going to be wrestling with all of these issues over the next few months, and they expect to come out with a list of recommendations, a list of things that their broad bipartisan panel of well-respected experts agree on a little bit later in the year. And we'll certainly, here at Planet Money, be all over that when it happens.
Yes, we will. That is it for today, though. Please remember to come back and check out the Planet Money blog, npr.org/money, where we've got an interesting letter from a biotech lawyer talking about Friday's podcast on copay assistance cards.
And keep sending us your comments, your questions, your concerns to planetmoney@npr.org. I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Alex Bloomberg. Thanks for listening.